market.
The S&P,
the ASX stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that wishes it was as cool as Bitcoin and Tesla. G'day, I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, the doctor is in the house, the good doctor, Dr. Ian Barnes-Mahanty. How are you, buddy?
G'day, Captain. I'm good. How are you?
I'm exceptionally well, thank you, mate. It's always lovely to talk to you and always lovely to talk with our listeners, or at least talk for our listeners. We do get a bit of interaction with our socials, and we'll talk about that later. Thank you for the tangent. But, mate, we've got a – I say it every week – we've got a full podcast. We've got a lot of corporate news. We are early on in earnings season, mate. And while I haven't been a whole host of big names, there's been a few. Of course, there's been a drama at Crown. How can we not talk about that? I mentioned Bitcoin and Tesla, and man, that's a heck of a story. We've got plenty on, including we'll dip into the full mailbag. And if we have time, Doc, I might even do a little bit of a mini high horse. Mate, a short horse, a medium-sized horse, a Shetland pony, if you will. What do you reckon? Should we get on with it?
Yeah, I bet that you are doing the high horse.
Let's get on with it.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, let's kick off with, I guess, I'm trying to work out what is the biggest news of the week. Actually, I was going to say the big news of the week. It's certainly been the story that had more column inches devoted to it this week than anything else. And by column inches, I kind of mean column feet, column miles. I think there's been about four or five stories a day about Crown Resorts and the decision of the New South Wales gaming regulator to effectively decide that Crown is not fit to hold a gaming license. That's not... I was going to say it's no small thing. It sounds obvious, right? Of course it's no small thing. But it's kind of a big deal in a million different ways. I don't know how to really get into this story. This was James Packer's kind of, again, I don't want to say plaything, but it was his company. It was his business. Obviously, majority shareholder. Had three nominees on the board. They had to give evidence to this particular gaming regulator in New South Wales. Packer did. Helen Coon and Andrew Demetrio. A plethora of people. And yet, they couldn't convince the liquor and gaming regulator that they were a fit and proper company to hold a gambling license. Mate, I guess I'll just have you ask your general thoughts, and I might ask you a couple of questions, but where does that leave you? Where does it leave the market, Crown, the regulator? How do you kind of see this story?
You know, funny thing is, given this is a gambling company, given this is a sort of old school type of gambling, I've actually paid very little attention to what's going on with Crown, with the theory that a lot of these things that have, you know, regulatory issues, effectively it becomes, you know, Crown becomes a turnaround. I mean, right, is it worth it from an investing point of view? I don't know. I mean, it's a fascinating story that they can't get a license, and that whole building was built on the premise that they couldn't have a license.
Although,
what I'll say is that I've heard really good things about accommodation. There's short stay and long stay accommodation there. There's also apparently apartments that you can buy there. So it's a fantastic building. Apparently, I haven't seen it, and I'm actually just looking at a picture. It looks fantastic. Adds to the Sydney skyline. So, I mean, I don't know. It adds something. They don't get the license, which means they can't make money off it, which is a small problem.
I mean, to some degree, the whole development was, as you say, yes, there are hotel rooms and yes, there are apartments, but they were in theory expecting most of them to be taken up by people who were gambling at the establishment. They're no longer able to do that. I don't know how many gamblers you're going to have come to Sydney and stay at Crown to then have to get in a taxi or a water taxi or something else and go across the harbour to the Star and gamble there instead. Maybe some, I suppose. But as you say, this was designed exactly for that purpose. Mate, one thing the question it raises, a million questions, of course. It seems like James Packer is going to have to sell out of Crown, or at least choose to sell out. The regulator was scathing about his evidence. Regulator was scathing about the evidence given by other people of the business. The culture of that company apparently is all wrong. It feels like nothing other than a firm broom right through the place would actually make the regulator happy. So there's that. I got to say though, remember, of course, Crown has gaming licenses in Queensland and Victoria and Western Australia. And it's got to beg the question, how is it that two different, or four different regulators, I suppose, but three on one side, one on the other, I'm left kind of wondering, you know, what does this mean for the rest of Crown's licenses? How does the Victorian or the Perth or the Western Australian regulator look at the New South Wales decision and go, yeah, no, we're okay here? You know, in theory, you should expect the same broad, you know, investigations and judgments on probity, on ability, on culture, on whatever else. The thing is that the regulator here isn't even investigating the Sydney Casino because it doesn't exist. They're investigating the company that has operations elsewhere. Surely shareholders and regulators elsewhere have to be thinking, man, if New South Wales has found some problems, what did we miss?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right because, as you said, there's no operation here. The operation is elsewhere, and this is a more of a an indictment sort of the company and not of the operations in New South Wales. So, you know, there might be more dominoes that has a domino effect. Again, hard to know. I mean, what the here's the thing, right? I mean, this thing is trading at still double of its 52-week lows. It's actually
right. And I guess to some degree, there is some sense that there's an expectation that Packer will sell out. There's an expectation that, as you rightly say, maybe this is the turnaround, right? I mean, it wasn't like most of the allegations weren't known already. The Chinese junket trips that were bought up, the regulator had a very dim view of Crown staff being arrested in China for doing things that broke Chinese law. We know, of course, that there were allegations, and I don't know if the tribunal's findings make them proven or not, so we'll call them allegations, of money laundering through Crown's casinos. I mean, this seems like a business where scant regard was paid, allegedly, to the laws of the different jurisdictions that it operated in. And that seems to be that the fundamental challenge that the New South Wales regulator has was saying, well, hang on, if you guys aren't prepared to play by the rules there, how can we be confident you're going to play by the rules here? And actually, it kind of seems reasonable. They kind of should, right? Like that should be the starting point. You are a business that is heavily regulated in a whole lot of different ways, including your requirements around money laundering, including the requirements around the ability to maintain payout ratios and make sure the odds are appropriate on certain games, all that kind of stuff. You kind of need the high standards of probity. This is a big come down for James Packer. I'm old enough and have been around in Australia for long enough, but Kerry Packer was the name in business. You know, when Kerry picked up the phone, yes, Mr. Packer was the only answer that you would give. Now, I never got a call from Kerry, thankfully. I was a little bit too young at the time, and hopefully even now I wouldn't have got a call from him. But there is, I mean, you know, he was, you know, the businessman. He was the guy that everyone talked about, that everyone feared, that everyone, you know, wanted to either do business with or avoid doing business with, depending on what side of the transaction you were on. But so Frank Packer originally, then Kerry, then James. There is that hackneyed phrase of shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations. James Packer's got enough grief in his own personal life, including, by the way, apparently some mental health issues, which are no laughing matter at all. But he's had a tough run. Whether he bought it on himself, whether he was a bit too cavalier, I guess we'll never know for sure. But for the Packer family, as you know, given their wealth, their name, their reputation, pretty surprising. I dare say this wouldn't have happened to Kerry, but maybe that's maybe I'm assuming too much.
Yeah, again, I don't know. As I said, I don't know the background enough of this company to say something meaningful. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, maybe it's a sign of changing times, right? I mean, there was a time when this sort of brick and mortar business with, was really the type of business that people invested in, and. Yeah. You know, maybe now is not the time for this sort of business, right? So, I really don't know, and that's perhaps the issue here is the type of business, difficulty of doing business in this sort of environment, the difficulty of maintaining profits in. I mean, as you said, heavily regulated. It's like almost like banking, right? I mean, you're making money on the cents on the dollar, right? So it's a tough business to be in, right? Yeah. And I don't know, that's my thought.
On the flip side, mate, the house always wins. I mean, I completely agree with you. On the other hand, and again, the price you pay matters. It's never going to be a hyper-growth business, as you rightly point out. But kind of when you've got literally regulated win rates, you know, all you got to do is make sure enough people come in the front door. And maybe that's the challenge, right? I guess maybe there's more entertainment here, maybe more options, more competition, you know, domestically, internationally. But at some level, you kind of do the math. You go, okay, we're going to play this many games of that particular, you know, roulette/blackjack/craps/whatever. But we know the win rates on those. As long as we keep people coming in the door, as long as we get more of them than last year, this, you know, it shouldn't be an overly challenging business to run in theory. Of course, as we know, theory and practice don't always match up, and Crown seems to have been caught somewhere in between. Remains to be seen whether or not they can make their way out of it. I'm also mindful, you're talking about new businesses, mate, and regulation, and it's probably I wonder how the regulators view these businesses because they're older now than they were. This might be a long bow, but we've seen them kind of give Uber and Airbnb and others a pass because, well, you know, they're new and they're innovative and they're doing some interesting things. Even you know, some peer-to-peer lenders and other things. In speaking of banking regulation, Afterpay even early on, you know, the if the established players had done some of these things, I wonder whether they would have actually been able to get away with them. You know, if Crown was an upcoming new digital gaming business, would it have the same focus as the Crown that we know? Given that it's established and more is expected of it, I don't know if there's anything there, or I'm just drawing a long bow. But it, as you mentioned, that kind of, you know, the established versus the new and innovative, it does make me think the older businesses seem to have a, I won't say tougher time. I don't necessarily feel sorry for them, because they're supposed to adhere to the regulations, but they seem to come under more focus, more scrutiny perhaps than others might.
Yeah, I mean, there might be something there. Like, I mean, eventually sort of the old gives way to the new, right? I mean, that's sort of what happens. I mean, here's the thing, right? I mean, internationally too, this sort of business, like, you know, running a resort, you know, a casino with gaming offering, I mean, these are hard, really tough businesses, right? I mean, if you think about something like an MGM, you know, MGM Resorts and, you know, and I mean, have they really, you know, grown? I mean, their, you know, revenues over time substantially, and their profits over time. So it's a hard business to be involved in. And, you know, like MGM, for example, right, had $9.5-$10 billion of revenue in 2014. It had sort of $10 billion of revenue in 2017, you know, and it's going to have $6 billion of revenue now this year, $6-7 billion because of, you know, COVID. It's just these are difficult businesses to run, and so I don't know. I mean, and then if you have other issues, then makes it harder.
I really quick on this, so we'll move on, but I am reminded of, you talk about regulation, new businesses and stuff. There was a time when people were calling for regulation of Walmart because it was killing everybody else, and that feels very quaint these days, as you say, because life's moved on, and Amazon's now the one people are turning their attention to. It'll be someone else in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, whatever it is. But yeah, gone are the days when Walmart was the big risk for the average shopper, right? The average retail outlet that was trying to compete. Things have moved on really, really fast. Mate, let's move on. Speaking of which, let's stick in Australia for a minute. I am going to get back to Tesla and Bitcoin, but rather than chop all over the place, let's stay with Australia and Australian corporate news. Commonwealth Bank. There was something for everyone in these results, mate. And I think I have a view of what your or a sense of what your view might be. But let's keep our listeners on the center hooks for a second. Profit down 21%, pretty ordinary. Cash profit, their preferred measure of profitability. I'm always a little bit skeptical, by the way, when someone gives you their preferred measure. It's like, we want you to look at this instead. So, you know, you've got to be a little bit careful that you don't end up getting distracted by that. But as long as they report it in the good times and the bad, I suppose there's some justification for it. Cash profit was down 11%. The dividend, though, was hiked from 98 cents to $1.50. That's the financial. So, you know, a bit of good, bit of bad. And as always, as we say every year, earnings season is about expectations as much as year on year. So the shares fell slightly yesterday. Last time I looked, I might have, not sure how they closed, actually, to be fair. But that, you know, they're a bit all over the place. But that was kind of not the world's, you know, worst result for the company. I did notice, though, in the commentary, some stuff, and maybe I'll make this broad, then we can narrow it back down again. But there were comments around the number of loans that, or the number of bad loans or deferred loans that had come down phenomenally. And the numbers were massive, mate. I haven't got them to hand. Here we go. I've got them here, actually. So the CBA had said, as I pull this up, oh, man, the internet's killing me here. This is good radio, isn't it? I love this. All right, here we go. The number, this is the AFR report. The number and value of frozen home loans has plummeted more than 80% from the mid-year peak in 2020 to just 25,000 loans now, worth $9 billion. That's a billion, that's a lot. From 145 worth $51 billion in June 30. Frozen small business loans fell to just 2,000 loans worth $300 million, down from 67,000 loans worth $15.7 billion over the same period. So I guess, you know, sum this up, things were bad. They're not as bad as they were, but they're still ordinary. CommBank is still allowing for that. So that's behind a lot of the write-downs and provisions they've taken. They've managed to put the dividend up because, frankly, things weren't as bad as they thought, and APRA's rules to make them, you know, kind of pull in their horns for 6 months has left them with a heap of cash that they frankly didn't need. They might have needed, by the way, in a different universe, in a different set of circumstances. All of that wrapped up, mate. What do you make of CommBank's result? I know you don't love the bank, but what good and what bad can you find there, and how do you feel about it after the results?
Yeah, so I have some after the fact thoughts, you know, and I'm making some of this up as you know, because again, I didn't pay too much attention to Combank's numbers.
our listeners will be flabbergasted by that. I know you're a bank diehard.
It's completely irrelevant to how I invest. You know, Combank can stay, go, die. It doesn't make any difference to me. So, I mean that jokingly. I think it makes some difference. Yeah, I actually have a bank account with Combank. So if it dies, it does have a problem for me.
But, you just realize you care a little bit more than you thought you did.
I have an account with them. So yeah, let's put that aside. So here's, I think, what's going on. I still think what we're seeing saw in the past was sort of the fake economy. Mm. What we are seeing right now is the fake economy. In other words, we don't have truth of any version or any sort of version. And I think this is what has happened, right? Or this is one interpretation of what has happened. The sort of the pandemic hit, people panicked, and given the carte blanche sort of approach, well, you know, you can ask for deferral for 6 months, 8 months. A lot of people took the deferral options, which basically resulted in people saving money. Then, you know, and then you have, of course, got JobKeeper, you know, cash flow boosts and things like that. So, you know, the policy intervention was swift and fast and of rapid, of
bloody huge,
of huge proportions, right? You know, a couple hundred billion dollars into an economy of like 1.6 trillion is a lot of money inserted, which would otherwise not exist, right? So it's basically, you know, quantitative easing. And so that has resulted, I think, in what happened is, well, now I'm not paying my mortgage and I've got extra cash and I've all, you know, and if I'm a small business, I've got cash flow boost and I've potentially got JobKeeper. Again, nothing, you know, exactly that was the intended purpose of the stimulus, right? Now, maybe people could, you know, and remember, people, corporations start paying rents to malls and mall owners and things like that, or other landlords, because again, they could legally without being kicked off.
Right.
So a lot of cash savings. And in retrospect, none of these businesses were probably as badly affected as one would have thought they would be, right? Sure. So that in turn has meant there's a surplus cash which has gone to retail, which has, you know, created a booming housing market. Effectively, the only thing that has changed is we basically got surplus cash in circulating in the economy. Nothing has fundamentally changed to the economy. The economy is not all of a sudden awesomely great or anything. It's the same economy from, you know, a year back, right? Chugging along, which has the same issues and the good things and the bad things that it had. So I think that's and therefore it doesn't now surprise me to see that the numbers have fallen, because hey, they've said you got to start paying, and a lot of these people who didn't pay have the capacity to pay, so therefore they're paying, right? So it's reflective that another way to think about this would be that the pandemic's worst affected people probably are not lenders or not borrowers, right? Maybe they're, you know, they are people who are renting. They're people who, you know, with the support have been able to actually pay they have now started paying the mortgages or not mortgages but the rent, which is then effectively allowing people to pay mortgages. So in some sense this has, so the stimulus has done exactly what it was supposed to do, and it doesn't surprise me. What does it mean for the bank? Well, that, you know, Commonwealth Bank is trading at twice its book value. That's pretty expensive by global standards. Wells Fargo Bank in the U.S. trades at 0.8 of book value. Usually people would say you buy a bank shares around maybe 1, 1.2 and you sell around 2. So that's that. Going forward, I think, you know, the banks are extremely poor quality investments return-wise. That wouldn't stop anyone from buying them, because people don't look at returns. People look at, you know, how much franking credits and dividends I can get. So exactly. I think, again, looking at the wrong metric, wrong incentives is sort of the, yeah. So that's what I think. I don't think the banks are investable. I think they're expensive. But, you know, bank results basically are telling us exactly what I would expect them to tell us. Or at least this is what I think they're telling us. But that's my story.
No, I like it, man. I think that's actually spot on. I think that actually that your last point in particular is a really perfect summation of what you said, which is the Bengals are telling us exactly where we're at, to my mind, and exactly as you say, they are reflective of what has happened in the economy. To some degree, they're a lagging indicator, and it's worth also thinking about those numbers because they were December 31 numbers. And of course, you know, as things move on, there will be a small group of people, by the way, who still are hurt by this, and we know that JobKeeper is coming off in March. So as Matt Comyn was careful to point out, you know what I liked about Matt Comyn's thing, mate? This is from an economic perspective rather than a company perspective. He sounded like an old-fashioned banker for a change, which is kind of nice. You know, for the longest time, bankers were, you know, and let's lose the stereotype, it was a bloke, so let's just stick with that, was the guy, you know, everyone knew, he went to everyone's house for dinner, he made the loans because he knew you or trusted you or knew what you did and how you did it. And that's a bit rose-colored glasses, but you know, it was boring, it was regular and normal. There weren't big risks being taken. They extended credit to good risks. They didn't extend to bad risks. Banking was really boring. And then for 20 or 30 years, it got super exciting, exciting in air quotes, because it led to the things like the GFC and the credit squeeze in the US. But his comments were kind of like, well, we don't know. We're being overly conservative. We're making sure we've got enough provisions. We're not sure how the economy is going to come out of this. And I just thought, for a change, and maybe it won't last once we get through this recession and back to normal times. But he actually sounded like an old-fashioned banker, which for me at least was a positive, and the way banks should be run. And frankly, they shouldn't be exciting investments, as you rightly point out. They should be pretty boring. They are too big to fail in the parlance these days. And so I'm all for boring banks. Man, let's stick with boring, because I know you'll also love this story, because I know you can't wait to get your teeth into the Telstra results. It was out this morning just before we started recording, so fair to say we haven't spent a lot of time on it. But profits went down about 2.2%, which is about what Telstra's been doing recently, just these couple of percentage points either way. It is about the most boring set of financial results you can read over the last, what, I want to say, 4 or 5 years, mate. This is kind of ticking along, roughly kind of, you know, treading water. By the way, doing a lot of work to tread water. Like, it's a lot going on. If you're the CEO, you probably think, man, I spent a year doing this and we got roughly where we started. That's got to be pretty disappointing, I reckon, if you're the CEO. The dividend was held, speaking of fully franked dividends, as you mentioned earlier. That's why I knew you'd be excited about this one. The dividend was held. I'm not sure there's anything more sacrosanct in Australian corporate life than Telstra's dividend. And so plenty of people this morning waking up and happy they're going to get paid out. Fair to say, by the way, a lot of self-funded retirees had a tough 2022, just as a quick aside, because of those dividends being cut. So they'll be happy that CBA is back and Telstra is maintaining its dividend. I will, you know, the only thing, I suppose, that makes you want to look twice at Telstra is the fact that it actually is still paying a dividend. As you mentioned before we recorded, 5% fully franked, there's nothing to sneeze at. Now, I should say I own Telstra shares, for full disclosure. I own them because one of our services actually sold them, the other one's kept it. And so I have to keep the shares under our trading rules, so I do own them. I don't expect they're going to beat the market, by the way, so if that sounds weird, that's exactly why. We sold them out of our market beating, or the service designed to beat the market. We kept it in a service that doesn't have that market beating expectation, but is focused on income. So just to get that out of the way quickly. That 5% fully franked yield, Doc, even you were a bit, what can I say, impressed or just surprised? What was your take on the Telstra dividend?
Well, like, I mean, you know, it's a telco, right? So, I mean, it probably has 5%, if it can, as you said, I think what you said is spot on. Like, I mean, if they can maintain the 5% from those people looking for income, this is better than buying a bond, right? I mean, you can buy the Australian bond and get no return. Maybe you have to pay the government to actually take your money eventually. Whereas in this case, if Telstra is giving you some money, no, the big question, the reason you get that is, big question is, you don't know whether you're going to get your whole dollars back eventually. So as you said, you know, you don't think this is market beating. I don't know. Like, I mean, the main question for someone like Telstra is, how much of market share do they lose to all these, you know, the new age broadband retailers that are offering basically all NBN. Everybody's offering NBN, and, you know, can you offer better service somehow, make it easier for customers, and then they take share. If they take substantial share, then you know, eventually their ability to pay dividends is going to decrease. But, you know, it's still, you know, it's interesting that the dividend yield is 5%. But again, for the risk you're taking, in which is basically that the capital can actually go down, that seems about right in my mind. Like, I mean, why would you buy Telstra unless you can actually get 5 or 6% dividend, right? I mean,
there's going to be something there.
Yeah, it has to be something, right? And maybe, when you know, when you use the franking and everything, it's actually, you know, grossed up, it's more like 7%. Actually, you're probably getting compensated for the risk you're taking. So, yeah, I think, you know, it's probably okay for income investors. You know, I wouldn't touch it, but that's me.
We'll get to some stocks you would touch in a minute, Matt. But yeah, look, I agree. It's a fascinating one. Of course, you know, if the share price falls more than the dividend, then eventually it does actually harm your return. So we would always encourage listeners not just to buy the yield. Plenty of times high yielding stocks have been an absolute disaster as investments because they've either gone broke or share price have fallen meaningfully. If you're getting a 5% yield rather than 3%, but your shares halve in value, that's 25 years you've got to wait to get the money back. So, you know, in terms of the increment. So you've got to be a little bit careful. Don't just buy the yield as ever. But as Doc said, with a reasonably reliable business. Mate, I'm still a little bit surprised / impressed with how the broadband resellers, the NBN resellers in particular, are managing to actually, this is a bit of a tangent, but managing to actually get brand and price differential when they're effectively retailing the same thing. I mean, you know, no-name products, private label products have been in supermarkets for years, and often they are the same thing. I certainly worked for a company in the past whose product was the exact same product as the Woolworths home brand varied at the time, literally the same product, but sold for probably 20, 25% less. If you buy NBN from anybody, you're getting exactly the same NBN. Now, yeah, there's maybe a bit of service difference. That counts for something, by the way. If you screw up, you want to know someone's going to help you. So there is that. But I'm actually, as I said, surprised. Part of me is appalled. Part of me is impressed that you actually can have NBN resellers with such broad ranges of prices and still manage to get plenty of business.
You know, that doesn't surprise me at all. Like, I mean, I have a Telstra service. And, you know, to just set up something called Give Me Electronic Bills, I can't do it on my own. I actually have to get onto the phone to figure out because, you know, it's something or the other in their, you know, remarkable number of systems that they've got interconnected. It just fails, right? And I've got the telephone number, I've got the account number, I've got the bill in front of me, and I just can't get them to, you know, allow me to create a login so that I can actually get electronic bills so that they don't have to post it and print it for me. It's that, you know, it's just, I think it's one of those things, right? I mean, if you started in the 19, God knows when, and if you started as part of, I don't know, Postmasters General or whatever it was at that time,
that's right.
If you started at that time, your systems are clunky. You have basically got a patchwork of stuff that is no longer, and it's, it reminds me of that, you know, of that submarine that needs duct tape to float, right? And such submarines do not float, and therefore they're definitely not fit to go to war, right? I mean, they're going to be able to defend nothing because the moment you put them in water,
you devote half your staff to reapplying duct tape all the time rather than actually doing what they're supposed to do, which costs you time and money and makes you slow. And it's a fun analogy actually to play with,
So it's basically that, right? I mean, the service is the service, but you just can't, I can't get the bill electronically because their billing system is just pathetic. And then to find someone to actually help me out is even worse because, you know, you call someone or there's some automated chatbot that shows up and there's this like community board that tries to help you. You can get on Twitter and somebody try to help you, but actually it'll take you a long time. So I think that's... I was thinking because given so many, you know, broadband retailers and some of them are really doing well. Like, you know, there's this one, for example, like Aussie Broadband. Like, and I thought, how can you be profitable and how can you do well, right? And how can you take market share? And this is it, right? You basically have an up-to-date system. You have a way of actually helping people. You know, the magic is you want to make sure the customer doesn't have to contact you. You need to have the right systems. And if you've got the right system, the customer never is going to contact them. They're just going to be happy because the stuff works, right?
Right, exactly.
And so these guys are new and they have basically spent the money doing it and customers are happy. So I think that's the nut of it. It's like, you know, so actually you can be a reseller and still do do well. You know, anyways, again, you know, I'm not saying go and buy Aussie Broadband, but I just think that, you know, the fact that they've got like such high review ratings,
That's amazing.
It's something.
Isn't it? People
it
love
is,
them. Yeah, it, yeah.
People love them, right? Yep. So that is something to think about, you know, and as an investment lesson, maybe, you know, if your customers love you, they're going to recommend you. They're not going to leave
right,
you.
Yes.
And you're going to spend less time servicing your customers, which is basically net an advantage for you. So you have a little bit more wiggle room to make money. So, I mean, you know, yeah.
Such an important component. Man, speaking of tangents, I'm going to do another one here because I in my head, I have some version. It's not a very sophisticated model, but a model in my head of there's innovation and disruption is really, really hard, right? Like to try and come up against Telstra and do well is stupidly difficult because Telstra is Telstra. And if you're a new player, you've got to get scale. You've got to overcome cash drain of the startup. You've got to get some sort of wide distribution or awareness. Like this is a really, really, if you and I started, you know, Doc Scott Tell tomorrow, We'd really struggle, and maybe we'd be successful, maybe we wouldn't. But it's really, really hard. So disruption innovation is really tough. The incumbents have a phenomenal ability to keep you at bay, but and there's a graph here somewhere that as you get to a certain point, your disadvantage becomes a phenomenal advantage for exactly the reasons you've pointed out. You know, if you can keep the little guy at bay, and most this is why it's hard as an investor, by the way, is that most little guys don't make it. And so if you invested in all the little guys, you'd invest in every gold miner and every biotech and every tech hopeful, and you'd probably, I'm pretty sure we'd lose money, right? If we invested in all the new ones, I'm pretty sure we'd lose money overall. But if you can start to refine your investment process and as a business, if you can start to kind of refine your own business, there is some point in a business's history and it's unknowable in absolute accuracy, you can probably get a rough version. But once you break through that, as you say, when you don't have to deal with legacy issues, legacy costs, legacy cultures, legacy systems, quite literally in Telstra's case, but plenty of others as well, once you kind of bust through that, then the world is kind of your oyster, right? Like, and I don't mean to make it sound super easy either, because you've got to keep working hard and they're always still going to try and drag you down. And there's plenty who've almost made it or who made it and then been dragged back into the mire. But there is some crossover where incumbency goes from being a massive, massive, massive benefit to an enormous drawback where it starts to actually hurt you as you try and compete with the new guys.
Yeah, I think I agree with that.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, let's do our last bit of corporate. And this one, I'm not going to go into a whole heap of detail unless you feel like you want to. No, the unit I know AGL particularly well. But it had a phenomenally large write-down. I want to say it was multi-billion, maybe $2 billion write-down, I think, of its energy assets this week. And look, I have said for a long time, I'm not sure if you have a view or if you had a view in the past, I think energy generation retailing is a stupidly tough business, and I've consistently avoided recommending any of those companies for our services. I imagine they never cross your path anyway, but from a share advisor perspective, where we look at medium and large businesses, these are, you know, the Origins, the AGLs. I've been asked more than a dozen times, should we recommend them? Do we recommend them? Why don't we recommend them? And my view has always been it's just a stupidly tough, hyper-competitive business where you're selling and reselling a commodity with massive fixed costs, right? It's a really, really tough business. I'm not claiming any prescience, by the way, in terms of AGL's downgrades. I didn't certainly expect $2 billion write-down. So I'm not claiming that. I'm just saying I don't know the business well because I've never bothered to look much past the broad industry dynamics because it's a really tough way to make money. What I thought was fascinating, Doc, is the write-downs were in the generation business because of expected and current lower energy prices. Now, that's great news for those of us with energy bills, which is all of us. So that's good. That's positive. But they also had to write down things like their wind farms and some of their renewable investments. And it just struck me, and I'm not a renewables expert. You know a bit more about it than I do because you're a Tesla shareholder and you kind of have spent more time looking at the details of renewable energy as a investment, and probably with your own science background. I'm an interested observer, but claim no expertise. Just fascinating to me that maybe the hardest challenge for renewables in terms of new investment is actually the fact that they're bringing down the cost of power. You know, the projects that are already in place, and so it actually makes it harder to get new projects off the ground. And that's same for coal, of course, same for others. So it's not saying it tilts the playing field away from them. But, you know, the wind farms that made sense at higher prices, that AGL did at higher prices, they've now got to write down because they no longer make sense. There is something of a, not exactly self-fulfilling prophecy, but when it comes to new projects, the success of renewables ironically makes new renewable projects harder to get off the ground. Is that, I mean, just an observation as I looked at those results and saw those write-downs. Am I making any sense? Am I on the wrong track? Do you have any thoughts from an investing perspective, an economic perspective?
Well, I think I think everything you said makes sense there. The main thing for me is, typically with new technology, right, there's a rapid cost decline, you know, cost performance decline, right? I mean, how much dollars do you need to spend to make, you know, how many dollars of, you know, worth of profit, right? And that decline sort of happens rather rapidly as the technology sort of starts to mature, right? And it's one of those things where if you're ahead of the maturity curve because you want to do the right thing, you might actually make an investment decision that is not really going to work out because, you know, like the wind generation technology maybe 10 years ago can no longer compete with the wind generation technology of today and maybe can no longer compete with solar generation technology today and maybe solar and batteries and things like that, right? So I think that, so it's a little bit of, you know, what did you back and why that comes into play. And I mean, you know, it's all, you know, everything is done with good faith. So it's probably a good decision then. It's not a good decision now, such is life. But it's something to be observant and careful about new technology is, you know, watch the maturity cycle, I guess.
And you kind of need some sort of vision or maybe even the willingness to be wrong or simply to make less money or even make a loss to kind of make some of this stuff work, right? That's almost part of the adoption curve. I know this is a really basic, boring example, right? But we got some solar panels on our roof. We got a quote and then we kind of sat on it for 12 months. We went back 12 months later and said, oh, mate, could you update the quote? We're ready to go. And it turned out that for whatever number of panels we wanted on the roof, we originally were quoted for 250-watt panels. We ended up getting 300-watt panels instead, so 20% more power generation for the same size for a lower price even 12 months later. So you call that, you know, probably, I mean, it's 25% increase in, 20% increase in capacity, probably something like 5 or 10% cheaper. So, you know, it's probably a 30% saving or, you know, net ROI increase, depending on which way you want to do the maths, just based on waiting 12 months. And look, it wouldn't have made it a bad idea to invest in the solar panels 12 months earlier. We weren't waiting for any economic reason necessarily. It was just interesting that exactly as you point out, investing early can still make sense. I think it's also worth pointing out, mate, and this is, I'm not going to go into this in detail because no one wants to talk about the boring part of accounting, but it's also worth pointing out that the way that your auditors and accountants do this work is they assign a value to an asset based on its likely future cash flows. And if those likely future cash flows fall, i.e. if energy prices are going to be lower in future, then they're kind of forced to take a write down to acknowledge that the cash generating unit, they call it in the jargon, simply was going to produce less cash than it was previously, and so it's therefore worth less, and so you've got to take a write down. That's kind of, as you say, I don't know, I'm certainly not saying it's an opportunity in energy in particular. I still don't like the sector, but there is some value in being able to look through those numbers as long as you've understood the value of the assets and the cash they're generating, because even an asset with declining efficiency, as you say, mate, or one that's less efficient or less attractive relatively than it was in the past can still be profitable. So I would encourage people to look through some of those accounting write-downs. While we're here, speaking of which, I'm going to take a very quick tangent. How am I going? One of our greatest investments at ShareAdvisor, I think it was done before. No, it was done, might have been done just before my time at running ShareAdvisor. It was a long time ago. Was a business called M2 Communications, telecommunications at the time. And it was funny, they were forced by accounting rules to write down the cost of their customer acquisitions over 3 years. And as if the customers would not be with them for more than 3 years. And yet the data showed very clearly the customers were hanging around. And so they were taking this accounting write down, which made them look like they were making much less profit. And you've talked about this before. It turned out if you looked at the cash flow rather than the accounting profit, you got a very, very different look at the business. And it was something like 16 times earnings, but about 12 times cash flows. And it's just one of those obvious times where you kind of look at it and go, okay, well, it's possible that the accounting numbers were right. If the customers were staying for less than 3 years, that's absolutely right. You should write down that cost. But when they weren't, M2 was actually making a whole lot of money that the accountants weren't letting them actually count as profit, which again, sounds a bit strange. I'm not even necessarily against the accounting rules. They're supposed to be prudent. But in that case, just a little bit of a look lower on the P&L, or not on the P&L, on the cash flow statement in this case, a little bit further through the annual report showed the real state of the business that was being masked in this case by an accounting rule that made the business look less profitable. And that's just most people probably don't want to do that level of research, and that's fair enough. But that can be a really attractive way to try and find some ideas. And you've talked about cash plenty of times, mate. The cash more than accounting profit can be a better sign of the real health of a business.
Yeah, the free cash flow is a really much better indicator. Just for all those reasons, I'm not ever implying that companies are actually doing the wrong thing. The companies are probably doing the right thing in terms of accounting. The thing is, the accounting rules, or like the standardized accounting rules, they're designed to work across industries, across companies, and so that people can look at it and make sense. But the byproduct of that is stuff that, you know, how do you amortize things? How long do you amortize it over? You know, when do you book the profit? Like, you know, when do you book the revenue? All of those things matter, right? Like you can have, you know, and typically, like, you know, for example, if you say are selling a software as a service and you get all the money up front, mm-hmm. I mean, that's a huge advantage, right? You've got all the money up front. Like, I mean, that money is not going to disappear. Even if your customer disappears, that money is in your pocket, right? But you can't recognize it. Revenue would show some sort of revenue recognition policy based on some revenue recognition policy, right? It would not show up. So I think, you know, seeing sort of cash, you know, what's the cash into the business is really, really useful. And I like to see that grow. That's probably, you know, the place where there is least fudging happening. Even there too, I think, like, you know, the way people say, you say cash from operations minus capital investments, right? But even that is very tricky, right? Because not every capital investment is the same thing.
That's right.
Right? So you could invest in, that's say, really good point. Buying computer hardware, which is you have to retire in 3 years, or you could, you know, capital invest in something that you have to retire in 25 years, right? Mm-hmm. How do you actually, you know, they're not the same thing. So again, if you subtract it out and you're just looking at free cash flow, well, so it's yeah, sometimes you have to look under.
I like that. I like that a lot, mate. And I think that's right. I think that's where, you know, people often say to us, and, you know, I'm with them. I've been there. You know, what's the formula? How do you pick great stocks? And, you know, we could write a book and not scratch the surface. Or we could do a 2-page pamphlet and it'd feel great, but it's rare that that approach, that simply using a formula like, okay, if cash flow is X or free cash flow is Y or profit is X or, you know, whatever, you know, that there are, it is the combination, and it's unsatisfying as an answer, right? But there is no easy answer. You've got to, it's practice and it's heuristics and it's, you used the phrase yesterday in a presentation we did for the Australian Shareholders Association, pattern recognition. And it's just being able to kind of apply that mental almost stencil over the top of something and say, does it seem to fit, and where are the bits that are different? And then really be able to interrogate those differences to work out whether there's an opportunity or whether it's a, you know, something that looks good on the surface but maybe has some underlying flaws that don't make a whole lot of sense.
Yep.
Speaking of not making a whole lot of sense, mate, I want to talk about Bitcoin. And I've got to say, the tech makes sense. I get it. Whether Bitcoin's worth $40,000, that's the bit I'm not so sure about. So this week, we saw Tesla. And I've got to say, you know, Tesla were really circumspect about this. It was buried on page, it was 160, I think, of their SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission filing. Well, they just mentioned in passing they've got $1.5 billion worth of Bitcoin. They may accept Bitcoin, they're planning to accept Bitcoin for new cars in the future. And they may or may not keep that Bitcoin as Bitcoin, or they may simply transfer it straight to cash and use it. They talk about using that Bitcoin for an investment opportunity and for diversification, if I'm not mistaken. Now, if you want to talk about Tesla's ownership of Bitcoin, feel free to do that. What struck me most is just the impact on Bitcoin itself. The fact that, you know, Elon Musk's imprimatur, whether it was deliberate or not, whether he meant or wanted people to care or not that he's doing it, certainly meant a whole lot for Bitcoin. It was up, I think, 8-9% maybe at one point, maybe ended up being higher when the news was first reported. It's no small thing, mate. You know, Tesla is now one of the top S&P 500 companies, one of the most valuable companies in the world. Musk is a certified, literally certified, he's effectively a certified genius. The guy doesn't make too many mistakes. You don't do well betting against Elon over the long term. It's easy to look at that and go, well, if Elon's in it, I guess I probably should be into it too. On the flip side, there's still plenty of questions that are yet to be answered on, you know, is Bitcoin really a thing? Is it going to be a thing? And even if it is, how do we work out a value? I don't know if you have any answers about it. I'm not going to put you on the spot on any of that necessarily, those specific questions. But just your thoughts on Bitcoin's re-rise, because it was, you know, flew high a couple of years ago, then spent a couple of years in the doldrums and everyone said it was over, and now it's back with a vengeance. Your thoughts on Bitcoin in the wake of Tesla's move, and just generally, now everyone's talking about it, we have to too. Where do you see Bitcoin as an investment?
Yeah, so I'm really not certain about Bitcoin as to what to make of it. That's my position, has been my position for some time, largely because it's, I don't know what it is serving, and I can speculate as to what, there are many potential reasons why Tesla would do what it has done. Some other companies have also done the same thing. So we can backtrack and let's put it this way. Tesla spent something like $1.5 or $1.4 US billion dollars in buying Bitcoin. That's a really small percentage of their $20+ billion of cash. So effectively, they're putting a very small, and if you compare that with their market cap, it's really, really tiny. So it's very basically a really tiny sized bet, right? Tesla's competitors spend more than that just on marketing. Right. So if you're GM, you would be spending $3 billion in marketing in US alone. Tesla spends, Tesla doesn't have actually a marketing line. Doesn't mean that it doesn't do marketing. But, you could sort of say that, well, this $1.5 billion effectively is marketing. And, the amount of press that this generated, it's free marketing, right? So that's you could take that view and say, well, it's a type of marketing and it's a different type of asset that sits. It adds, here's the other funny thing about Bitcoin. Bitcoin sits in, if you read that page, it will say that it basically sits as a digital kind of asset. It's not regarded as a security or of cash, currency. Right?
That's right.
It's
not currency,
right? So effectively, and here's the funny thing with the rule, the price of Bitcoin goes up, it has no material impact on Tesla's accounting earnings, okay? You actually cannot bump, your earnings do not go up unless you have realized the sale and made a gain. However, if Bitcoin price caters in half, you actually have to write it down and you have to take the loss.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly. Good point.
And in fact, if Tesla is planning to buy more Bitcoin, there is no reason for them to be actually talking up Bitcoin because because if they talk up Bitcoin, price goes up, they're spending more. And then if it goes down, they basically have to take it right down, which is going to look bad in their earnings report. Now, of course, analysts might back it out and things like, okay, that doesn't matter. We'll just, we'll look at it at market value and maybe they'll do it. So there's this accounting reason to it. I think, if I had to speculate, a third reason why this is being done, I think it's really a small side bet. But the side bet, I think, is as follows. The total amount, I've read the statistics somewhere, the total number of US dollars injected into the global monetary system last year is something like 40% of the, or 30% of the total amount of dollars circulating.
Right.
It's a phenomenal number, right? What that would do, and we've already seen some effect of that, right? So we're seeing that for example, the Australian dollar is now trading at a much higher price relative to the US dollar maybe like a year back, right? So so there may be some concern that the US dollar basically because of money printing or quantitative easing is becoming less valued relatively. So you're basically losing money value. And one of the ways in which you can keep money value is we're basically buying a scarce asset, right? So and why is Bitcoin a scarce asset? Bitcoin is a scarce asset because there are only a finite number of Bitcoins out there. And so that's basically I call it, in my mind, it's just a hedge. Basically, it's a hedge. It's a put option purchased against cash, which basically says, well, if the US dollar basically goes down, we have that. And that's one theory I have. But again, that doesn't convince me otherwise to
it's purchase. Hard, right? Like, so I'm a Bitcoin skeptic, literally in terms of I'm putting myself right in the middle. I'm not a bear. I'm not a bull. I'm just a straight out skeptic. I'm straight out. I don't know. I wrote about this earlier in the week. Again, if you want to jump on the socials, you can find that link. I'm happy to have an I don't know view. There's no penalty in, as Warren Buffett would say, no called strikes, which is a baseball term, means not much to Australians. But effectively, you can stand there all day in baseball. If the pitcher gets the ball in the strike zone, you're out. In investing, there are no called strikes. You don't have to swing, and if you don't swing, there's no called strikes. You won't be out. You can wait till the pitch you get. Now that's that's a Buffettism, and we can go either way with that one. But broadly, with Bitcoin, you don't have to have a view, right? That being said, mate, I am fascinated with the idea that companies, investors, people are buying Bitcoin who weren't otherwise buying gold, but for similar reasons. And the only thing that kind of gets me on all this, and this is not about, I don't want to talk about Tesla and Musk and anyone else really, it's not a big deal, but just more the idea that if there are people who have that view, there are some people who are now 22 and could never have bought gold 10 years ago because I was 12, right? So, not everybody. But if you make the argument that people are making about Bitcoin as a store of value, as an asset, then, those people should have, under the same rationale, other than the fact you can't physically carry it around, there's some reasons why not, but should have otherwise held gold on the same basis, right? I wonder to what extent people are getting a little bit excited about this because it's kind of cool and digital and techie and stuff, rather than actually kind of being, if you said, here are my problems with cash, this is why I want Bitcoin, but you weren't already holding gold, I'm tempted to kind of question whether, where the thought process is around the coolness of it and the fact that everyone else is doing it, and the fact that, it seems to be going up. Is there any credence in that, or am I being too unfair?
I think there's one hole I can think of in your thesis comparison with gold. So I think there's no such thing as a finite supply of gold. Basically, you can dig more gold effectively out of the ground, right? And it's a function of gold production process and demand. Yeah, I think one of the biggest differences here is effectively the best way to think about about Bitcoin, actually even the stock market, is demand supply, right? And here you know that the supply is constrained because there is a cap on the supply, and effectively if there is more demand for it, the price basically has to go up. There's just no way around it, right? If more people want Bitcoin, the price is going to go up. And whether we like it or not, that's basically the demand-supply equation at work, which doesn't actually apply to gold. I mean, there might be, basically, the more demand for gold results in more gold production, gold price goes up, there's more gold production, the price comes down. That cannot happen for Bitcoin, effectively. So I think that's the big difference. And maybe some people are basically making the bet, well, if there's more people interested in a finite asset, and if that asset happens to be Bitcoin, then basically Bitcoin technically could be the largest valued company on the planet. So it's that, whether you want to make that bet or not, I think there's a big difference between this and gold. I had to make a store of value bet, I would absolutely make it on Bitcoin and never touch gold. I just don't know whether it is there, right? I mean, so that's what I think is, but I'm more or less with you in the sense that, to me, it's a little bit of speculation, but I think there's a difference between gold and Bitcoin.
I think that's fair. I think that's absolutely fair. I'm not entirely sure it makes the case for either asset for what it's worth, but I take your point. There is something very finite and specific about Bitcoin that gold doesn't have. That's absolutely fair. So I'll withdraw my objection, mate. Let's move on. I'm gonna have a little bit of a mini rant. It's time for my mini high horse. It's one of those stories that I talked last week about the cashback loans, and I talked about the fact that I thought it was a bit of a questionable thing, and I mean not questionable. Everyone's allowed to do it. It's completely ethical, legal, moral, all that good stuff. Except that it's kind of one of those distraction things, right? Don't look at the interest rate. Look at the cash I'm going to give you instead. Let me bamboozle you. Let me dazzle you with the cash. Look over here. Look over here. Don't compare the rates. Just take the cash. There was an ad I saw this week, and I had to mention it, mate. It won't be a long one, this one. It was from one of the big banks. I think it was one of the international banks. I couldn't find the ad this morning, so I'm not going to name the party just in case I get it wrong. They may sue me, but more importantly, it wouldn't be fair, so I'm not going to. But they were asking for investments of $500,000, $500,000. And in return, the investor would get a gold coin worth $1,000. Now, you don't have to do the maths. I'll do it for you. That's 0.2%. That is nothing. That is tiny. It is immaterial. If you got $500,000, 0.2% is immaterial, except the ad's out there, mate. You know why the ad's out there? Because it works. And if you want to study of human psychology, there are better, there's plenty of them, but there are very few better options than that one, where someone with $500,000, who in theory would pass the sophisticated investor test, that ASIC set out for needing less in terms of product disclosure, all that kind of stuff. $500,000 you're going to put with a particular investment bank because they give you a $1,000 gold coin. And I just thought, you know what? It's not it's the people who drive across town to save 2 cents on petrol. And we all laugh and they go, oh, if you do that, that's great. You spend $20 on petrol saving $5. This is the other end of that scale, mate. Exactly the same problem, exactly the same psychological biases and traps for someone who's investing half them. In theory, they've got a few million bucks. So you're not going to invest all your entire life savings, maybe you are, with this one investment bank. So let's assume you've got 1 or 2 or 3 million bucks. These are the people they're targeting. And yet, this bank is hoping they'll be able to swing people with the offer of a gold coin. And as I said, they wouldn't offer it unless they actually either thought it would work or knew that it worked. And it's just a reminder that as rational as we all want to be, even the rich and famous fall for the same traps that we do. So that was worth highlighting, mate, because it's a bit of fun.
Who doesn't love a gold coin? Like, I mean, you're basically saying you don't want a gold coin. You know, somebody's going to melt it, smelt it, put it together, give it to you in a nice box. It's going to look like a gift. And you're just telling people that that's not useful.
I'm saying I'll take it as well as the best offer you've got rather than instead of.
It's the beautiful gold. It's going to look shiny. It's going to come straight from Perth Mint, you know. It's beautiful. I mean, you know, like it's, yeah, like it's that, yeah. So you can go and buy you can buy a garden hose and you can spend $100 for a garden hose or $10 for the garden hose. I mean, why do people spend $100? Because they like that. It's the same thing.
Very, very funny. All right. Anyway, I just thought it was one of those, you know. Anyway, do knock yourselves out. Grab your gold coin if you want, but don't let anyone hoodwink you to stop looking at the total return for the sake of a shiny thing. I get it. Just don't do it. Mate, let's finish off, as we always try and do, with a bit of mail from the mailbag. We got a question from Buzz. Buzz says, "Hi, Scott and Doc. Please use the code name Buzz. And Scott, I am female. I know you get a kick out of the fairer sex investing." I do indeed, Buzz. I don't know how I feel about people giving themselves their own code names. I kind of like it on one level. It's kind of cool, you know. Maybe we should have code names. If you had a code name, what would your code name be, Doc?
I'll take Buzz. Buzz sounds like a really good
name. I think Buzz is already taken.
Anyway. I'll take Buzz 2, Buzz 3, Buzz New.
Like
even better one,
like
Buzz 007.
Buzz again. Oh, there we go. James Buzz.
All right.
Anyway, here's the question. Love the podcast and I'm a member of a number of your services. Thanks, Buzz. A huge thank you for the education, insights and recommendations. I've managed to build a solid ASX-based portfolio based on your recommendations and now I would like to focus on buying your US stocks this year. The trouble is, the dollars don't go far once you consider currency conversion and the individual stock price of the recommendations. And just to break this down a little bit, currency, of course, you have to convert. And right now you're getting 77 cents for every Australian dollar. So there's a bit less to go around. And as Buzz says, the average American company, Doc, just because of a quirk of the way that Australian and US markets have kind of evolved, the average US share price is probably be 5 times the average price in Australia. Is that fair to say, mate? Is that a rough, if I'm trying to think about the companies that I know, about 5 times, maybe 10 times the average price. Just not that it matters because it's all about the, you know, size of the pie, as we always say. But the average US share prices are probably, 5-10 times higher than ASX.
Yeah.
Anyway, Buzz says.
Yeah. $50 to $100 sort of is the average you'd probably be looking at.
Yeah.
Somewhere in the $50 to $100. Yeah.
And it doesn't take much for a $100 stock to double or triple over time. And obviously it's a $300 stock and that feels super expensive, right, compared to buying Woolies at $40 or, I don't know, CBA at whatever CBA is, $80. All right, here we go. I know that one of the golden rules of the Motley Fool is to have a minimum of 15 to 20 stocks in a diversified portfolio. However, sometimes the budget only allows for purchase of one or two of these US recommendations. And Buzz says, Doc, I'm thinking of Tesla here. At a time. I have opened an account with Stake, as you guys have pointed out the importance of US investing, but I get discouraged when I see how much a single US share costs. My question is this. What's the best way to start a US-based portfolio on a limited budget? Is there any point in building up to 15 different entities if you can only afford to buy one or two each of these? Many thanks in advance. Let all fool on. Thank you, Buzz. I love the code name. Thank you. And thank you for being a female listener and correspondent. I do get a kick out of it. There are too many blokes in investing and not enough women, and the more we can redress that balance, the better for everybody. So you're dead right, Buzz. And if you have any friends, female friends, please send them to our podcast if you wouldn't mind. All right, buddy. What do you reckon? What would you suggest to Buzz?
Yeah. So you could choose to buy. So you could basically decide. I think it's better to think in terms of the dollar figures that you're investing. And then as you add more capital over time, basically you can add to those positions that you want to add to and maybe leave those positions that you don't want to add to. So it shouldn't be. I mean, it's in theory, it just seems like you have less number of shares, but that is not material, right? It's basically material as what percentage of your capital you have invested towards a particular company. And the only thing that really matters is whether or not that investment is good or has the potential for, you know, delivering market-beating returns, then whether it's an ASX or in China or in America or in India or Brazil, it really doesn't matter. What matters is whether or not you get the returns. Mm. And again, returns on, on a currency considered basis. So you absolutely have to consider that as well. But so I think, you know, it seems like she's on the right path here and if you buy one or 1.5, two, that's okay. Mm-hmm. That's fine.
Mm-hmm. Yep. I think it's a really great point, mate. Yeah. Look, I'll go a bit further on fractional, which is basically what you said, just to kind of give a different perspective on the same example, which is if you had 10 $20 shares or 100 $2 shares or one $200 share, it's kind of the same thing. And it feels like I, at one point, Doc, I can't remember what company I owned. It was one of the US companies. I had 10 shares at one point. And it feels weird. Like, it genuinely feels weird. Because it's like, you know, we used to buy. I've also bought in the past. I bought some for my sins. And I'm losing money on it. So this is not a recommendation. I bought some RFG shares when the price fell to 14 cents. They're down about 8 now. So more fool me. But, and when you buy 14 cent shares, if you're putting, a couple thousand dollars in, all of a sudden you got all these shares coming out of your ears. And you kind of, it's all these shares. You go, wow, there's an amazing number of shares. But as I said, $102 shares or 10 $20 shares or one $200 share or 0.1 of a $2,000 share, it's exactly the same thing. So, Buzz, don't get discouraged. I know it really is weird. I don't know if the Americans find it as weird as we do. Maybe they're more used to it or used to higher prices. But it's weird buying one share or a fraction of a share and feeling like it's like, am I even trying here? Is it even making a difference? Do I even bother? But you have to try and get your head around the reality, as Doc says, by the dollar value, not the number of absolute shares. Because the company could split its shares 100 for one and you'd have 100 times as many shares but the same interest, and it would be exactly the same thing. It'd feel less weird, but it'd be exactly the same thing. So that's really important. In terms of diversification, we would say you don't need 15 to 20 ASX shares and 15 to 20 US shares necessarily. So don't think about diversification, at least in my view. Doc, you may disagree, but I don't think you do. We'll find out. Don't feel like you need to have a 15 to 20 stock ASX portfolio and a 15 to 20 stock US portfolio. In fact, we're actually do the reverse, be completely exchange agnostic, buy a diversified portfolio of stocks by absolute means, but don't feel like you need to have that diversification per exchange. Think about your portfolio as a whole. So if you only buy, if you've got 15 to 20 ASX stocks, you want to add two US stocks, then great, you've got 22 stocks in your portfolio. So you're actually increasing the diversification anyway, but don't feel like you have to get to 15 and 20 to make it useful. It's not the way I would think about it. Do you agree, Doc?
Yeah, I think I agree with that. What I do is I basically have a single spreadsheet for different accounts, nice. Actually.
I like that.
And I just keep, the only thing, I actually don't even have the cost basis there. The only thing I really have there is the total number of shares I have and the current share price adjusted to essentially Australian dollars, right? And that basically tells me, well, how much do I have invested in Australian dollars today? And even individually, I can look at the percentage allocation to each individual company and tells me, whether I'm overweight, underweight, whatever. So that's a pretty meaningful way of doing it. Yeah, you can get to 20, 30 companies and get, as long as they're not all banks and miners and all insurance or all tech in the same tech field, you can, 30 companies, 20, 25, 30 companies can easily get you decent diversification. I mean, most of the benefit of diversification should show up if they have been picked properly.
Nice. Love it, mate. Now, if you're like Buzz, and you should be, or more importantly, if you think Buzz is on the right track, and you should, why don't you join Motley Fool Extreme Opportunities? That's Doc Service, he runs with Kevin Gandia, and you can join EO for a very special price, inexpensive price, a wonderful value proposition joining EO. If you go to fool.com.au/EO podcast, please do, because I think you'll find it worthwhile. Past performance is no guarantee. We can make no promises about the future either. What I can promise is Kevin and Doc are doing their absolute level best to bring you the best stocks they can find. The most recent recommendation was out just this Wednesday gone. For those who listen to our podcast, you may find a small amount of amusement. I won't give too much away, Doc, because I don't want people to be able to guess it too easily. Let me just say that when you join EO, or if you're already an EO member, as you're listening to this podcast, look back at the last Extreme Opportunities recommendation. I think if you have a bit of a read, you'll get at least a little bit of a giggle. Put it that way. And if you don't, drop me a note. I'm happy to help you out. But I'm pretty sure you'll work out what we're talking about. All right, mate. In the meantime,
I'm just gonna quickly add one thing. You know, there's nothing to do with that amusement, and the amusement was a byproduct of the stock recommendation.
Deliberate, you're saying?
It was not deliberate. It was in no way deliberate for anyone who's listening to say that, you know, oh, well, we got to have this recommendation because of that reason. But we thought this was a really, really interesting company. And just a little teaser, it's a really interesting company in a very interesting area of technology.
I agree.
Which is not pure technology. So this technology plus, you know, that's enough for a teaser.
Go
add the value.
I was going to add some value. So the value was not depending on how you think about my stock picking, but I did say to you yesterday when I saw what it was, we're recording this on Thursday, as I normally say. I did look at it yesterday, and I was actually looking at that only, I think it must have been early this week, late last week, and I looked at it, I thought, gee, that's interesting. I kind of didn't get quite far enough through to actually have a really good look from an investment perspective, a really formal final investment view. But I wasn't surprised to see it in the service, and certainly an interesting company. As always, higher risk than the average ASX company, but as always, with higher return potential. So look, if we haven't given you enough reason to join EO, I don't know what more we can do. That was all unscripted, by the way. It was just a bit of fun. But yeah, do go to fool.com.au/EO podcast. Get a special deal for our podcast listeners. Join EO for the joke, if nothing, for the laugh, for the enjoyment. Because you love us, because you love Doc. All right. Speaking of which, though, if you do want to get in touch with us on the socials, as I mentioned, let me quickly run through them. If you're listening every single week, you probably know this off by heart. If you do, that's great. So, hey, hit us up. If you don't, and you don't know off by heart, here we go. You can hit us up on email, info@fool.com.au. Nice and easy, info. And our member services team will make sure your email makes its way to us. If you're on Twitter, that's the only place you can catch Doc's, exclusively on Twitter. So you can get him at Anirban Mahanti. I'm at TMF Scott P, and you get The Motley Fool at The Motley Fool AU. Follow those accounts for us. Feel free to leave us a note, direct message, or tag us in your tweets. You can also get myself and The Fool account on Instagram at TMF Scott P again, and at The Motley Fool AU, same on both Twitter and Instagram. And on Facebook, The Motley Fool Australia and Scott Phillips Money. That's how you can get hold of us. In the meantime, please make sure you do subscribe to the podcast, because we love our followers. We don't want you to miss anything. And also, the reality simply is, the higher we are up the charts, the more we're likely to be noticed, and the more people hopefully will enjoy what you're enjoying. So please do subscribe. Please tell your friends. Leave us a review and a rating if you don't mind. As I always say, feel free to skywrite it, but please don't tattoo it on yourself. Don't make us responsible for your mistakes. And of course, don't forget, you can get a dose of foolishness and a little bit of marketing from us straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM. Triple M. That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. Surprise, we'll be back on Sunday with a special mailbag edition and some more foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.